All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live here from the heart of Silicon Beach in Santa Monica, California, with the Internet Law Center. And we have a very special show for you today. We have with us Ross K. Baker, who's a professor at Rutgers University and has a new book out, Is Bipartisanship Dead? A report from the Senate. And so are you with him, Professor Baker?
I sure am.
So that's quite a league to be in, you know, with the intro of Kari Ostremsky and Kobe Bryant. But your topic is much more serious and not as old in terms of is bipartisanship dead? And your book is obviously going to be getting a lot of discussion, particularly in light of the election results. How do you think the election plays into your findings?
Well, I decided to look at bipartisanship in Congress by looking at the Senate. And I decided the Senate for the same reason that Willie Sutton explained why he robbed banks. And that's where the bipartisanship is. The House is not, by its very nature, a bipartisan institution. If you've got a solid 218 votes, and now the Republicans are going to have something like 242 votes, you can do pretty much whatever you want without taking into account the minority party. So the Democrats have a very, very limited influence in this new 114th Congress. However, the Senate is different. The Senate is a place where smaller chamber, the senators get to know each other better because they serve on many more committees together than House members do. And I interviewed six Democrats and six Republicans in the 113th Congress and asked them the question, is bipartisanship dead? And to a person, they said, no, it's not. And then they proceeded to give me examples of the kinds of bipartisan cooperation that they've been involved in with members of the other party. And some of the Democrats are pretty liberal, like Barbara Boxer from California. And some of the Republicans are pretty conservative, Senator Johnny Isaacson of Georgia. So what were they talking about? I mean, clearly the Senate hasn't been able to pass any bipartisan legislation. So where is all this good bipartisanship going? And the answer is that within the committees of the Senate, there's a lot of it. The problem is that when it gets out of the committees and onto the floor of the Senate, that's where the really intense partisanship cuts in. That's where Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell come forth and basically plant the flag of the Democratic and Republican parties. And much of what these senators want to do in a bipartisan way gets trumped by what the party leaders see is the conflict between their bipartisanship and the needs of the party base. For Reid, it's liberals, union people, environmentalists, and so on. For McConnell, it's industry and religious conservatives. So the problem is that so long as these folks are in their committees, agriculture, armed services, environment and public works, whatever, they're fine. They get out on the floor and the dynamic changes completely.
So obviously it's kind of an odd situation because you're talking about the committee structure and committee chairs are appointed and ranking members are appointed by party leadership and by the membership. And then they clash with the leaders that serve them is what you're saying.
Well, that's interesting. You're right in a sense that, you know, that the Democrats currently in this Congress are the chairs of all Senate committees. They will be Republicans in the next Congress. And they have these positions by reason of their party's majority, but
right.
They're also these committees are really have jurisdiction over particular areas of policy.
Right.
I mean, the folks on the Armed Services Committee really have very close relationships with the Pentagon, with the defense contractors, with the aerospace industry, and so on. And these are very long-standing ties that really are ties between these constituencies and the committees themselves. Like the Agriculture Committee, of course, has their constituency in agribusiness and farmers and so on. So the needs of these various groups may, and very often are, in conflict with the objectives of party leaders.
So, for example, take Ted Kennedy. What a lot of people didn't know was Ted Kennedy was on the Armed Services Committee because
right,
there were
yes,
a lot of
was.
Military installations in Massachusetts. And
correct.
So someone like that, obviously, once your committee base is also your fundraising base, would it not be?
That's absolutely correct. And there's some committees in Congress that are known as money committees. And they're known as money committees not because they spend it, but because they can gather in lots and lots of campaign
right.
contributions.
And
right.
the granddaddy of that would be the Finance Committee, which I don't know whether it was the Senate Finance Committee or the House Ways and Means Committee, that you know,
either
the corridor
one, either
outside
one.
is known as Gucci Gulch. You know,
that's exactly
that's
right. Yeah,
that's where the tax code is written.
Sure.
So basically, if I'm a senator on a money committee, I have to choose between satisfying the constituency I serve, the constituency I have jurisdiction over, and Harry Reid or Mitch McConnell. And
exactly right.
My electoral success may depend more on the first two than the latter.
That's absolutely right. And I think that there are times in which very loyal Democrats or very loyal Republicans have to part company with their leadership because it's in conflict with what their constituents want. I mean, the constituents are the ones who are responsible for either sending them back to Washington for another 6 years or retiring them. And senators who stray too far from the needs of their constituents, you get into real big trouble. Pat Roberts, for example, the most recent election, had developed a reputation of somebody who basically had gotten a terminal case of Potomac fever. You know, he didn't really have a legitimate voting address in Kansas. And really, the Republican Party had to come to his rescue because he was in very deep trouble. So senators have to understand that as much as they become policy experts and feel comfortable with their policy constituency and also with their party constituency, the bottom line for all of them is re-election. And re-election depends on satisfying the folks at home.
And, you know, your book starts off with an interesting tale, somewhat maybe alarming. It's what would seem to be a non-controversial vote, to the extent there is such a thing anymore, over ratifying a treaty for the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And obviously because it's a ratification vote requires two-thirds, and it had been passed favorably with strong support from the Foreign Relations Committee. Wheeled out to support the bill was former Republican Majority Leader and Minority Leader and Presidential Standard Bearer Robert Dole, you know, himself a disabled senator, former senator and, you know, war hero. The vote failed.
Yes, the vote failed. You know, it was, you know, what you call colloquially a no-brainer. I mean, who could be opposed to a treaty that protected the rights of persons with disabilities, particularly because it imposed no costs or obligations on the United States? The thing was that this was going to use the United States as the gold standard for accessibility to handicapped people. We are the best in the world. There's nobody better than we are in terms of making sure we have curb ramps and getting people into public buildings and just making sure that the lives of disabled people are easier. So, you know, this would have set up our standard for the entire world, and it wasn't ratified. And it wasn't ratified for some strange reasons, one of which is, candidly, the United Nations is toxic in the Congress of the United States. I don't think there's any organization, perhaps only ISIS, that has a worse odor than the United Nations. It's a feeling that anything the United Nations does is an infringement on the sovereignty of the United States. So you start out with that strike against it. And then you add to the fact that there was a lot of conspiracy theories that were circulating around that if the treaty were ratified, it would interfere with the people who want to homeschool their children. It would somehow have implications for abortions and so on. And, you know, the internet was just buzzing with all kinds of crazy stuff about this treaty, which had been reported out from the Foreign Relations Committee on a bipartisan vote. Was co-sponsored by John McCain, a Republican in good standing by any measure, and John Kerry, who was about to become Secretary of State, yet it failed.
And it's an interesting thing because you hear different stories, and obviously you're talking about the Senate versus the House because, you know, there's a famous quote from former House Majority Leader Dick Armey that bipartisanship is date rape. And so that the House definitely comes with a different viewpoint. And then the Senate, I hate to keep mentioning Kennedy, but I recall about it upon his passing, you know, the close relationship he had developed with Orrin Hatch. And in his eulogy, he mentioned that, you know, I came to the Senate to get rid of Ted Kennedy. And over time, and, you know, eventually I failed and I realized that was a good thing. And, you know, so they developed a warm relationship. And when he died, you know, Hatch actually hoped but was somewhat pessimistic, I think, about, you know, maintaining civil relationships like that in this kind of modern TV age.
You know, I just speak to older senators. Let me tell you about an incident that happened to me. I was having lunch in the Capitol with Senator Leahy, whose staff I was on back in 2004 when I was on sabbatical. And he and I were having breakfast, and Chuck Grassley, the senior senator from Iowa, came by.
Right.
And, you know, it was sort of like two old fraternity brothers, kind of grabbing each other and punching each other in the arm and so on. And Grassley walked away, and Leahy said to me, and she said, "There goes a real pro. There's somebody who I don't agree with on many things, but he's completely honest, smart, he's well-informed, and it's a pleasure to work with him." And, you know, but, you know, that's hard for many people to say in public.
Right.
Because the public itself is so polarized that, you know, a Democrat who prizes the friendship of a Republican or vice versa is going to have to explain himself to the party base, you know, the liberal Democrats in the People's Republic of Vermont saying to Leahy, "What are you doing palling around with this guy?" Or in the case of Grassley, you know, geez, you know, Leahy's this liberal Democrat. Why is he your big buddy?
Yeah, I'm sure Ben and Jerry's goes over well politically in Iowa. But the interesting thing is that I recall that when Gingrich came to power in 94, that one of the things he told members was not to spend time in Washington over the weekend. And I can understand the political necessity of that. You know, you need to go back to your base. You need to do your work. You need to be out there. You need to be seen. You don't need to be seen as a body of, you know, something who's been captured by Washington. But that part of that process was also preventing fraternization, which I think Gingrich also discouraged. And I'm wondering, as you know, it's been now over, you know, 20. It's been, I guess, 20 years now since that revolution.
And exactly 20 years.
Are we seeing that has somehow, because a lot of the people who, you know, were in the House now have graduated to the Senate. Has that polluted really the kind of relationship in the Senate?
It's made it very hard. I think that the whole problem of campaigning and fundraising and so on has had a really devastating effect on relationships in Congress. That these members have to spend so much time on the phone. You can't actually you know, you can't solicit funds from the Capitol or from the House and Senate office buildings. You've got to go off campus to do it.
Right.
And both party organizations have set up offices on Capitol Hill, and members leave the campus and go into these townhouses and make telephone calls. That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time from everything. It takes a lot of time from meeting constituents who happen to be in town. There was a time when if you were, you know, coming to town from Florida or, you know, from California or someplace, you stood a pretty good chance of hanging out for a few minutes at least and having your picture taken if you're a member of Congress. Boy, that's not easy to get anymore. You're lucky to get a staff member to shake hands with you.
I'm looking at an interesting stat. It's from Mother Jones, and it's how much each senator must raise an hour to for their seat. And obviously, you know, California is the most expensive of that's listed here. This is a 2012 study. I guess they have people who are up then. But, you know, Barbara Boxer raises $2,444 an hour. Mitch McConnell, $1,700 an hour. And so if that's what you have to do, you know, of course, you know, you have to dive in to all those other things, and, you know, having a beer with, you know, Senator Grassley or, doing whatever bizarre things Rand Paul may do, is not a priority.
Right. Well, you know, at least in the Senate, there is a little bit of ability to kind of work in these encounters in the votes. See, on the House side, the vote is by electronic ballot. So what you do is you come over from your office, let's say in the Cannon building, and you go over to the Capitol, you take out your car, you put it in the voting machine, you vote, and you go back to your office.
Right.
In the Senate, it's by voice vote.
Right.
So you come over there, and senators have a chance to hang out in the chamber together. And that's where the conversations take place. That's where the deals get made. I mean, they're made other places as well. They're made in the gym. They're made, you know, simply by visiting other senators' offices. But
or the monocle.
It's hard. Right, or the monocle, right? the crab cakes are great.
Yeah, some people actually do have food there. We only have a few more minutes, unfortunately. But so tell us about. I mean, so you worked in you did a fellowship at the Andhra Judiciary Committee. Did you work with Ed Pagano perchance?
I certainly did. I know him very well, and I followed him when he went to the White House as congressional liaison to the White House liaison to the Senate.
He's a great guy. We worked together on Clinton in '96, but. Tell us about what you're doing at Rutgers.
Well, I'm teaching the large introductory course in American government, which I've taught for the last 26 years, and love doing it. I love doing it because I really want to get students interested in government and politics. I want to stimulate their interest in participating because, you know, you're dealing with kids who are going to be reasonably well-educated, and we'll have a lot to offer. So I'm doing that. And then I'm also, at the end of every semester, I have three teaching assistants because the class is so big. It's about 400 students. And I can't really get to know them very well. So I asked my TAs, I said, give me the names of 13 of those students, a baker's dozen. And I'm going to invite them to have the meet in my house, in my living room, to have coffee and bagels on a Wednesday morning in the fall semester every other year. And we're going to talk politics. We're going to talk about the federal election that's coming up. And it's an opportunity for them to really learn more about elections, about candidates, and particularly familiarizing themselves with elections in other parts of the country. So, most college students are very provincial, and this is an opportunity for a kid who grew up in New Jersey to track a bunch of elections in Oregon and Washington State.
And you've been doing this 26 years. Are you noticing any change in terms of awareness or interest, or is it basically, you know, students are more or less approaching things the same they always have?
Well, you know, I think that there was a period probably in the 80s in which it seemed to me that a lot of the students really weren't as engaged. Not so much as in, let's say, in the late 60s and 70s. I think students really are interested. But there used to be a kind of benefit that we gained from pre-laws, from people who were preparing to go to law school, who would take political science under the faulty theory that somehow it helped you in law school. But we benefited from it. And that's changed because very few of my students are going to law school these days. I mean, I used to write literally dozens of letters of recommendation.
Interesting.
I think I've written three this semester.
Wow. I mean, I followed that path in the 80s when people weren't paying attention, as you say, and went to law school. But so if people want to find more information about you and your program at Rutgers, where should they go?
Well, you can go to the website, which is www.rutgers.edu, and they're going to give you a list of programs to click on, and you know, ours is political science. Or you can just go directly to our department website, which is www.politicalscience.rutgers.edu, and learn about the programs that we have, and also about our faculty. And we have a display of the book that our faculty members have written, and it's a really pretty good site.
Three quick questions. First, who is your great hope for bipartisanship in the Senate today? Two, what's your next book? And three, what do you think about your governor's chances for 2016?
Question number one. I hope that Mitch McConnell's as good as his word, that he really wants to bring the Senate back to what it was at the time that Mike Mansfield, the famous Democratic leader, was the majority leader. It was one in which the committees did real work, that there was a realistic chance that what the committees did might be enacted. It's a nice thought, but we'll see. I think it remains to be seen whether that's even possible these days. So that's my hope. And it really is in his hands as the new majority leader.
Yes.
Now, what's your second question?
The second question is, what's your next book?
That's a good question, and I, frankly, I just got done writing this one, so I'm sort of in the ebb tide of that project, and you know, and making a lot of appearances, and of course, the other thing is the election came off so quickly on the heels of the book being published, and you know, I've been swamped by people asking for interviews, so that's the answer to that question. And
all
the
right,
third was
number three, which I'm sure you're getting asked all the time, is your governor's chances in 2016.
Well, you know,
can Mr. Sit Down and Shut Up be president?
Yesterday had some good points and some bad points for Governor Christie. The good points were, as the president of the Republican Governors Association, he had a lot of conspicuous wins in unlikely places. I mean, Sam Brownback held on in Kansas, Rick
wow,
Snyder in
something.
Michigan.
Yeah.
and you know, he got another term for the Republican governor of Georgia, Nathan Deal.
And then
so,
Massachusetts,
yeah, he did
Maryland.
Real well, most unlikely place, Maryland, yeah. The bad news is Scott Walker was reelected. And Scott Walker, of course, really, he and Christie kind of occupy the same political position in the Republican Party in looking ahead to the 2016 presidential campaign. They're both governors from bluish states who are kind of more centrist than most Republicans, and they're going to have to fight it out.
Well, we'll definitely have to watch that. Well, thank you very much. The book is Bipartisanship Dead, a report from the Senate from Professor Ross Baker. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you for some very, very probing and intelligent questions.
It's been a pleasure. Say hi to Ed for me.
I will be happy to do that. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Oh, yeah. My day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
Whether you are an online business or domain name investor, you need access to the best names. With over 270 million domains already registered, finding the right names at the best price requires a great wingman. NameJet.com puts you in the pilot seat by giving you fast and unparalleled access to some of the best premium and expired domain names on earth. As the number one domain name auction platform, NameJet.com is the best place to find domains for your business or investments. So light the afterburners to the domain name aftermarket and fly over to NameJet.com at Mach speed to get great domains today. NameJet.com.
Johnson, what's this mantis I keep hearing about? Do we need to call an exterminator?
No, sir. Moby Mantis is our new SMS marketing tool.
SM what?
SMS. Text messaging. Moby Mantis lets us communicate directly with our customers in real time. We can send promos, coupons. It even lets our customers market for us by sharing offers with their friends online. It's been great for business.
Sounds expensive.
Actually, I sign us up for an extended free trial. It hasn't cost us a dime.
Good work, Johnson. I guess the only thing we'll be exterminating is the competition.
To get your free extended trial of Moby Mantis, text RADIO to 21691. That's RADIO to 21691 for Moby Mantis.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
The following is an encore segment of Cyber Law and Business Report.
And so we have one of the preeminent experts and journalists, and when it comes to tax policy and its maybe abuse, and Pulitzer Prize winning author David K. Johnson, and he's we have him from his home in New York. Are you with us?
I sure am.
I want to thank you for joining us. And David came to prominence, I think, from through the New York Times, where he was its tax reporter, and he won a Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for his penetrating and enterprising reporting that exposed loopholes and inequalities in the U.S. tax code. And that I'm assuming that also led to your book, Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax Systems?
Yes, it was actually led to three books. It was a trilogy I've just finished. The first one, Perfectly Legal, is about taxes, and it won the Investigative Book of the Year Award. The second book in the series, Free Lunch, which came out 5 years ago, is about subsidies to very wealthy people that very few people knew about. And then my current book, which came out last September, The Fine Print, is about restraint of trade and the rise of monopolies, duopolies, and oligopolies, and the damage done both to smaller businesses and trying to compete and to consumers.
And that's through the fine print in various legal documents, correct?
Absolutely.
Oh, I wouldn't know anything about that whatsoever.
Nobody reads it unless they get paid to read it.
There's a famous instance, and you probably heard or are familiar with, and 2 years ago on April Fool's, a UK game site called GameStation or GameStop.
They offered $3,000 to the first person who spotted the thing that said, email us and we'll give you $3,000, the equivalent of $3,000.
Oh, no, that was another one.
Somebody finally did, but it was like months after they put it up on the web.
No, this one was just for one day, and it was more creative and more sinister, which means they had the lawyers involved. And it basically said that you had two options. You can register, and in which case you are transferring us in perpetuity, an option to your eternal soul, or you can opt out and get the equivalent, and get £5. And I think it was in the neighborhood of 12 people opted out. 12% 12% opted out.
And
I always thought that, you know, if they really were serious about the prank, that the next year they for April Fool's, they should have opened up a soul division. But so now
well, you know, Judge Richard Posner, who is, I think, without question, the most widely read jurist in the country from all of his books and articles, told a legal conference a couple of years ago, and I recount this in the free print, in the free fine print, that when he was refinancing his home, he said, "I didn't read, I just signed."
True.
And so if Richard Posner doesn't read the fine print, then, of course, all sorts of things get buried in there that we're just not aware of.
Now, I'm sure that happens in an alarming rate. But also alarming is I've seen that, for example, Apple is sheltering up to $1 billion a week offshore through various concoctions known as the Ireland, the Irish, and the double back to the Virgin Islands. There's all these
things. Well, it's called a double Dutch sandwich with Irish in between. Yes, one of the most important and least understood trends in the U.S. That's damaging the FISC, the Treasury, is in 1986, as part of the Tax Reform Act, Reagan signed a provision that repealed the excess retained earnings section of the tax code if you had the money offshore.
And just for our listeners, excess retained earnings, what would that be?
Well, Congress, since the corporate income tax began in 1909, has always had a rule. It's changed from time to time, but it's always had a rule that says you cannot hold on to more cash and near cash, things like today money market funds or
right.
treasury notes, than you need reasonably to operate your business. Otherwise, a corporation would just become a giant bloated tax shelter, and profits that are earned, instead of being recirculated through the economy through dividends, salaries, purchase of new equipment, further investment, would be effectively stuffed into a mattress. And this 1986 rule said, well, exception doesn't apply provided that you have the money offshore, which of course means mom and pop and purely domestic businesses are sort of out of luck. And what happened after the passage of that law is that immediately American companies began selling their intellectual property rights, the logos for a hotel's signs, their patents for drugs, the manufacturing process they have that's exclusive, the thing that makes, for example, and I don't know if this one applies, but all Thomas's muffins are alike and they're all different from everybody else's. They began transferring from their American companies to offshore subsidiaries and tax havens. Then they start paying these subsidiaries royalties. And that turns profits earned in the United States into tax-deductible expenses held offshore. And so long as that money is not brought back as profits, there's no tax on it. And while in theory you can't borrow that money, you actually can. What companies do is they set up laddered loans from themselves, so they borrow $1 billion this week from Cayman Islands subsidiary number 47, and then they repay it, and they borrow $1 billion the same day from subsidiary number 82, so they do get the money back to use it, but it grows untaxed.
And it seems, you know, when I hear that, and I've heard things similar things described before, it seems that the tax code is divorced from economic reality. That in a but-for world where you're not making decisions based on tax, that transaction would never happen.
That's exactly right. This is entirely mining the tax code and mining the treasury. And one of the lessons that business has learned since 1980 especially, and that we've seen, you can document through the explosion of the growth of the tax code and the number of lobbyists of all kinds in Washington, is that it is easier to mine the public treasury for gold than to earn profits in the marketplace. And so we have all of these devices that have been stuck into the law, and I get told about new ones all the time, and there are many of them you can't find unless you know who put in this section unrelated to that section somewhere else, unrelated to two words somewhere else, that create tax favors for various corporations or industries.
It's amazing. And the idea, I mean, it's ironic, you're citing the 1986 law, which was introduced to simplify our tax system. And basically you're saying it created a fantasy land and playground for creative tax accountants.
Well, the Tax Reform Act in some ways was very good law. What's happened now is we've had 25 years of lobbyists working their way through it to undo what was originally planned. I mean, there's certainly problems we can see now with the 1986 Act. The probably the most widely understood one is the alternative minimum tax, under which if you get cancer or someone in your family gets cancer or some other very expensive illness, Congress in some cases literally raises your taxes by reducing how much you're allowed to deduct for your medical expenses. That is the definition of an immoral tax. And
right.
Since I first exposed that back in 1999 when I was at the New York Times, more than 100 members of Congress have in various forums said that's wrong, but you know, nobody's done anything to fix it. By the way, the money's very small. It's about the best estimate we've been able to come up with is about $50 million a year that it costs taxpayers because so few people are affected. But if something only costs $50 million, why can't you
fix it? Why do it? Yeah. I mean, I always thought that they always index the AMT, or they don't index the AMT. I forget
what
it is.
They temporarily index it, and that was one of the tricks of the Bush administration. When George W. Bush came in, he wanted $1.8 trillion in tax cuts, and the Senate was only willing to give him $1.3. So the way they achieved it was they approved the $1.8, and then they took back what turned out to be more than the difference through the alternative minimum tax, which is essentially a tax on two-income families who own their house and have more than two children and live in the high-tax states, which is to say that states that pay high wages. It is often misdescribed in the news media, and I've tangled with my former employer, the New York Times, over this. They describe it as a law originally imposed to address investors or just wealthy people who were piling on deductions. That law was repealed in 1986. That was called the minimum tax, and replaced with this wholly different law that is essentially the most anti-family law in the country. But all the politicians in both parties who get up and tell you, I'm here for the American family, they won't do anything to fix that because it's a real moneymaker.
And so was AMT, as distinct from the minimum tax, was AMT added on for revenue purposes?
Yes. When the promise of the 86 Act was something called revenue neutrality. We're not
right.
going to raise any more money under the new system than under the old system. And when they plugged all the numbers into the Treasury Department's computer, they came up short $1 billion. And so they thought this would be this would fix it. It would raise about $1 billion. Purely by happenstance, because I didn't cover taxes in those days, I got hit with it. It took effect in 87. I got hit with it in 1988 because I was involved in litigation over an investment property, and that made the litigation expenses in theory tax deductible, except under the AMT they weren't. So I wasn't able to deduct any of the business costs I had. And so I became aware of it, but I didn't write about it until I found a family who really illustrated the problem, and I got a perfect family. A couple in a lawyer in rural Kansas. They have 15 children. They're Presbyterians who don't believe in birth control, and one of their sons had cancer. And I got their tax returns, which they made so little money, $90,000, and they have 15 children, they had to pay this tax. I put their tax returns for several years into TurboTax, completely replicated them. They had done them by hand to save money, and then analyzed them by adding and removing children to see what happened. We did a whole chart showing how just having 15 children put them into the alternative minimum tax, and then the medical bills to keep their son alive, who's now a grown up, and his childhood cancer has gone away. raised their tax, their federal income tax bill.
Wow. And it looks like that. Yeah, I know that the 86 Act was given life at the Dubliner pub and D.C. in Capitol.
Yeah.
And maybe they spent a little too much time there, it seems. But
well, it fundamentally it was pretty good law. I mean, it has some unintended negative consequences. The AMT is one. What has happened since then is this incredible gaming of the system. Now, I write for Tax Analyst, the nonprofit premier tax publisher of tax news in the country. But there's an organization called CCH that does technical tax manuals and things. And by their count, the tax system broadly defined, that is the statutes, the IRS manual, revenue rulings, private letter rulings, all of that that they put in their publications, it's grown 80% since 1995.
The manual.
80%. The total amount of pages has grown 80% in the last 18 years. And, you know, this is not about you and me and most of the people listening to this. The expansion of the tax code is because of these basically rents sought by very big companies and very wealthy individuals who hire lobbyists, and I contend that they actually own Congress. Some people think that's a little too strong. Okay, so they buy congressmen now and then for short periods of time.
They rent them now and then. They deduct and have a carry forward if they don't get elected. But I've worked with lobbyists in Washington, and I don't take that cynical of view. But what I've been troubled by is this growing use of offshore, and particularly we in the tech industry and Apple being the kind of the model company, supposedly, it has, and along with, and others are now following suit, this enormous sums offshore, which on one hand, they're using a court system and to get a record patent verdict, and they want us to amend our immigration laws so that we can have more educated graduate students, but they're not paying into the system because it's all going offshore.
Well, this is this is the real fundamental problem. Unfortunately, over the last 30 years, and remember, that's long enough now that the whole politics of the country have changed. I always say there are two dates that matter to understand America today, 1980 and 37. 1980 was the year Ronald Reagan was elected and took the country in a whole new direction. Whether you like him or don't like him, he changed the country. And 37 is the median age. Half of Americans are older and half are younger. Well, I'm sorry, 37, if you were born 37 years ago, you don't know anything about, from your own experience, the world before Reaganism began, mm-hmm. which we're still in. Obama is maybe Reagan-lite, but he's a Reaganite. And this has totally changed our views of things in this country. And so what corporations now, and it's not all corporations, there are 6 million corporations in America. But 2,600 of them own over 80% of the assets. That's 0.00043% own over 80% of the assets. They're the ones who are gaming the system. And they are building up these huge amounts of money offshore. It's, by my count, about $3.4 trillion. Now, a lot of that money, by the way, is here in the U.S. They deposited an account with Chase Bank in New York, but the statement for that account will say, tax haven subsidiary number 416, Bermuda, or the Cayman Islands, or Switzerland, or Singapore, wherever they've put the money. And so it's even a fiction that it's offshore. And this has several negative effects. You can track the I'm actually building a spreadsheet right now with the help of one of my graduate students, showing that you can track the decreasing number of jobs in America on one line and the rising amount of cash offshore, and they parallel pretty well. That doesn't mean they're cause and effect, but they're correlated. And it leads to encouraging risk-averse behavior by CEOs. Something like 22% of the money raised through stock offerings in the 60s and 70s was savings, and the rest was immediately used to build a new factory or invest in research and expand the company. Today, it's the reverse. About 75% of the money from new stock offerings gets stuck in the bank. I don't know about you, but I don't buy stock in companies so they can put it in the savings account at the bank. I can put my own money in the savings account at the bank. I don't need to pay them an overhead charge for it.
No, one thing I know it leads to is a commercial break, but we'll be right back with Pulitzer Prize-winning author David Johnston and more on perfectly legal and other tax issues after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Hey, this is Danny Sullivan to talk to you about Bruce Clay Incorporated. They've made Inc. Magazine's list of growing private businesses and have exhibited and sponsored at my conferences since the very beginning. You've seen their search engine relationship chart or you've read their SEO code of ethics, so you know they're SEO experts. But did you know they can help you with PPC, web analytics, web design, marketing strategy, promotion, and branding? Yep, get everything you need for success in the online marketplace. You can check it out from the professionals at Bruce Clay Incorporated. For over 10 years with offices worldwide, they've got the answers you need. Check them out today at BruceClay.com.
ShipStation helps online retailers ship orders faster. It's so easy to set up and use. ShipStation gives you tools to automatically import, manage, and ship your orders in the most cost-efficient way. Save money with the best USPS rates possible, as well as a free USPS account. ShipStation integrates with all the most popular e-commerce platforms and shipping carriers. Get shipping done no matter where you sell or how you ship. WebmasterRadio.fm listeners get an additional 30 days free after the free 30-day trial. Go to ShipStation.com/WebmasterRadio now. Shipping Nirvana starts here.
Introducing Rumble, the smart mobile management system, the first end-to-end mobile platform where you can make real-time app modifications from a point-and-click dashboard. Want to change the design of your app? Point click and it's live in real time. Want to change the ad map of your app? Point click and it's live in real time. Want to change the content mix of your app? Point click and it's live in real time. Power your mobile business with Rumble.
Are you ready to rumble?
Visit www.rumble.me.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
The following is an encore segment of Cyber Law and Business Report.
And we're back with Pulitzer Prize-winning author David K. Johnston. David, are you still with us?
I sure am.
And so it's interesting, we were talking before the break just about the extent of the your offshore income being shipped and its effect on economic activity, or at least its correlation. And so do you really think that basically the monies, or is it, or just as a fair assumption that the monies that are going offshore could be contributed to the economy and aren't, and we're suffering accordingly?
I firmly believe that. Earlier today I was speaking to the head of one of the biggest accounting firms in the country, and he was agreeing with me about it. Friday night I was on PBS NewsHour with Douglas Holzeken, who was the chief economic advisor to Mitt Romney and was a George W. Bush White House economic advisor, and he was fundamentally agreeing with me about the principles of this. And remember, that's the corporate side. We also have these huge amounts of money that individuals are putting offshore, although in many cases they have a business that's just an alter ego for them. And we had the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists got this leak of data that appears to come heavily from Singapore, showing that, for example, the number two guy in the French, what we would call Treasury Department, after repeated denials, actually had a huge cache of untaxed money stuffed away offshore. I mean, this is not everybody by any means is doing this, but lots of people are, and government can stop it. It chooses not to stop it.
And I guess I seem to recall after 9/11, Stanley Tools moved, which had been based in
New Britain, Connecticut.
I was thinking, I wasn't sure it was Middletown or New Britain.
And Stanley Works CEO, who was an acolyte of Jack Welch, he had been a high executive at GE, he had this plan to move the company on paper only to Bermuda. And I calculated that it would have increased, if his own projections of what it meant to the company worked, it was worth $383 million in additional pay to him. He did not get to do it because he rigged the election. And if there are a lot of things that the Securities and Exchange Commission may fail at. It may not, you know, pay attention when Bernie Madoff gets reported to him. But if you rig a shareholder election, that's one that they stand up on. And Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut, then the Attorney General, went after him over this, and they never did actually on paper move. But other companies did. Ingersoll Rand makes, you know, compressors and all sorts of heavy machinery. They did move their company headquarters on paper, meaning literally they just rent a mailbox and pay right. Paid the Bermuda government about $26,000 a year, and as a result, they estimated they were going to save $30 to $40 million a year in taxes they wouldn't pay the federal government.
But it seemed that, and maybe it was just the PR spin, but Stanley Tools retreated because this was right after 9/11,
right?
And there was just a huge PR backlash, and. But it seems that now there's no shame in it. And,
oh, that's worn off. Yeah, that's worn off entirely. There is the only thing that's really changed, and there are people who either blame me or credit me with this, depending on their point of view, is that surveys taken in the early to mid-90s up to the late 90s showed that the public did generally sort of thought the tax system was okay. They had rather mild criticisms about it. Now it's clear the overwhelming majority of Americans in survey after survey believe the tax system benefits the rich and comes at the expense of most people. That's been the change. But the details of it, that's something else, and it certainly has not affected the Republican leadership on Capitol Hill, who are still pushing the same old, which is essentially lower taxes for those who have had the greatest gain because they are in the United States.
And it seems that as this progresses, and to the point that, you know, we have Apple, you know, trying to blackmail the U.S. government, saying, "Well, we'll bring the money back if you give me a tax holiday."
Right.
Have these companies, given the size of their wealth and these tax systems, have they become almost nation states of themselves?
Yes, and
the idea of an American company that actually will sometimes think of American interests, you know, like Ford, during World War II and converting production to the war effort. I mean, is that notion entirely gone?
This idea that you're an American company is really on the wane. It's not true everywhere. But you remember, while the Twin Towers were still burning, one of the big four accounting firms, and I forget which one now, had a webinar for its clients that I got a copy of and put on the New York Times website, where a partner at the firm said, encouraging companies to do this Bermuda mailbox deal, that patriotism should take a backseat to profits. And even mentioned, you know, the 9/11 attack. I mean, that's how callous this has become. And, you know, the simple fact is you cannot continue to be wealthy in a sick society.
Right.
You've got to have a healthy society if you want it to endure. And the invention of progressive taxation and its moral basis is what gave birth to democracy in Athens 2,500 years ago. This is what I teach in the law and the graduate business school now at Syracuse University. And this has been largely lost. The idea that taxes are theft, that you get nothing for your taxes, has become remarkably pervasive. I actually had a student when I spoke at Yale a few years ago say to me, "So what do they do with all these taxes? Is it like the garbage in New Jersey? Do they take it out in the middle of the Atlantic and open up the bottom and dump the money?" And I have to tell you, my first thought was, and I hear I always thought you had to be smart to get into Yale.
We have a recent president that went there, so think twice on that one. But
yeah.
It's astounding. But I know you're short on time, and you have another engagement. But I want to thank you for joining us. This is a very important debate, and it's not just about Apple or other Facebook or Google's offshore account. It's really about what is our role as citizens, even as businesses. And I think that gets lost in this debate. And in a week when we have a horrific event, when you see people come together as citizens, maybe this is a good time to talk about it. But I want to thank you for your...
I hope so. Thank you.
I want to thank you. Good luck with your book, and I'll shoot you the information about the selling the soul. I didn't sell
mine. That's
great. I quit it. I'm a lawyer. It's already been leased. But
thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.
And one of the David K. Johnson, Pulitzer Prize winning author. And so it was really quite a coup to get him for today. This is Bennett Kelly from broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center in Santa Monica, California, the heart of Silicon Beach. Looking forward to talking to you next week. Court's adjourned.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmaster.fm. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.